Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Gareth Barlow, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 14th of June, these are our main stories. After pleading not guilty to a slew of federal charges in connection with mishandling secret documents, Donald Trump hits back at his opponents. We'll have the latest from Miami. Meanwhile, our Kyiv correspondent James Waterhouse reports from a Ukrainian village liberated from Russian forces. And...
Whoever watches this video, I was kidnapped yesterday. They are demanding $4,000 for each one of us. They beat us day and night, non-stop.
A special BBC investigation into the horrific treatment of some Afghans fleeing via Iran and Turkey. Also in this podcast, inflation in the US falls to the lowest level in 2 years, fueling speculation that interest rates may not have to increase. And how the world's most famous early human ancestor, nicknamed Lucy, could walk fully upright and live in trees. But first, we are certainly entering a plea of not guilty. The words there of Todd Blanche, Donald Trump's attorney, in court in Miami on Tuesday. For the first time in American history, a former US president was arraigned on federal criminal charges. He's accused of taking top secret documents with him when he left the White House and storing them at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. After the brief hearing, his motorcade then stopped off at a Cuban restaurant to meet supporters on the day before his 77th birthday.
Happy birthday, dear Donald. Happy birthday to you.
While Mr. Trump is facing many other legal challenges, all of them, he says, evidence of a Democratic Party witch hunt to stop him running for president next year. He is, after all, the Republican frontrunner. At the restaurant, the former president had this to say.
I think it's a rigged deal here. We have a rigged country. We have a country that's corrupt. We have a country that's got no borders. We have a country that's got nothing but problems. We're a nation in decline. And then they do this stuff. And you see where the people are.
He then left New Jersey to go and speak at his golf club in Bedminster. Our correspondent, Nomia Iqbal, is in Miami.
He arrived a lot earlier than we had predicted he would. And when he got here with his Secret Service detail, he entered the underground tunnel of this building. So this is a 14-story glass building in Miami surrounded by palm trees. He entered the building and he went on the 10th floor, we understand, where he then entered the chief judge's court with his lawyer. He was wearing a dark suit, red tie. He had his arms folded and he was subdued. We had reporters inside the court. They weren't able to use their mobile phones because it's a federal court. There's no cameras, there's no pictures, none of that. But he was subdued, he was stoic as the charges were read out to him. Also inside that courtroom was Jack Smith, the special counsel, the former war crimes prosecutor who brought this case against Donald Trump. Donald Trump was then processed where he was fingerprinted. There's no mugshot.
There were concerns from some quarters, certainly awareness that potentially thousands of people could have arrived outside the courthouse. They didn't. But he is using this whole scenario to build support. It feels as though the way people support Donald Trump has changed slightly now. Maybe fewer demonstrations and protests and more people now digging in, giving him money, trying to fund that presidential campaign for 2024.
Well, Miami police are prepared for potentially 50,000 protesters to turn up, and that also includes those who are against Donald Trump. But we estimated there were probably about a couple of hundred protesters outside the court, very vocal, very loud, carrying their flags. And also you had those on their motorbikes and trucks going around the courthouse shouting that Donald Trump is innocent. In terms of the support, I think it's fair to say that he still has a huge base, especially in Florida. It's a Republican-leaning state. He won it in the last two presidential elections. I've spent some time here chatting to people, and they do believe that he is being persecuted. They believe in this narrative that he has put out there, that this is a weaponization of the Department of Justice by President Biden. They believe in that message. And the last indictment in New York, which were state charges, so very different, we saw his polling going up amongst Republican voters. But there are also those other voters who don't necessarily identify as Republican, more independent voters, who have told me that they are fatigued by it, that they would rather Donald Trump, if he is going to be out there on the campaign trail, talk about his policies, talk about what he would do if he got back into the White House rather than airing old grievances.
That was Nomi Iqbal. Well, Craig Green is a professor of law at Temple University in Philadelphia and has been telling James Kumarasamy more about the charges.
One of the most extraordinary things about this indictment is the level of detail that it provides. There are particular documents, some involving nuclear secrets, some involving battle plans. And in terms of Trump's handling of those documents, there are two particular audio recorded vignettes where he was actually showing some of these documents off to visitors at Mar-a-Lago, including a writer and publisher. He says, oh, and this is an attack plan, and it's all very confidential. And if I were president, I could declassify it, but I'm too late now. This is all extraordinary, particular evidence from the prosecutor about the mishandling of documents. They have photographs in the shower, on the stage of a ballroom, this sort of a thing. And then by comparison, the cover-up, there are text messages and we're led to believe testimony from particular Trump aides that talk about how Trump himself arranged to have boxes of documents moved to hide them effectively from federal investigation and indeed from his own lawyers who were participating in that investigation. So I think the prosecution's evidence is very clearly laid out in the indictment. And on the defense side, I think the main arguments that have any plausibility at all are these arguments about lawyer-client confidentiality. Some of the evidence in this case has come from Trump's own lawyers. The things you see in the public eye are arguments, well, it's selective prosecution, and why didn't they go off against Hillary Clinton or Mike Pence or Joe Biden? These kinds of arguments routinely put forward in the press by criminal defendants, these have no clear bearing on the legal merits of the case against Trump. It's no defense on the playground or in the criminal court to say everyone's doing it.
To get a conviction, the prosecution needs to convince the entire jury. How difficult do you think it's going to be to get a unanimous vote in Florida?
I think it could be difficult. The question in a certain sense is whether there's a likelihood that a juror, notwithstanding strong evidence and powerful legal argument, might just decide it's unfair or unjust to go against Donald Trump. And this is called jury nullification. I think there's always a risk of that. There are procedures in place and questions that can be asked. But I think that's one of the major dangers that the prosecution faces. It's a disadvantage of having the case in Florida versus some other place like D.C. or, of course, the New York indictment on other charges. But I think that's one of the big risks. The other is that a president can pardon people from federal charges. So advancing a little bit into the realm of the hypothetical, if former President Trump became future President Trump, it's conceivable that he might try to pardon himself from these charges.
You've answered my next question, which is if he were to be convicted, would he be able to stand and serve as president?
Yes. The only way that a president can be disqualified is actually to be impeached and convicted. And of course, Congress has tried that twice already with President Trump. The fact that he were convicted even of a crime in New York or in Florida would not prevent him from being president, which means that the Republican Party and the American public will confront the question as a live political question, not a legal one, whether they wish to have such a person potentially as the leader of the federal government. That's a decision for the voters to make, not for the judges, jurors.
That was Professor Craig Green talking to James Kumarasamy. Well, Ukraine is saying it's taken several towns and villages in its counteroffensive against Russia. Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, claims that Ukraine's offensive has stalled. He told war bloggers that the losses on the part of Ukraine have been much greater than those on the part of Russia, and that it's already lost well over 150 tanks.
Their losses were approaching a level that could be described as catastrophic. The enemy was not successful in any area. Russia has suffered 10 times fewer losses than those of the armed forces of Ukraine.
Well, to see the reality of the fighting, the BBC's been able to get a closer perspective on the front line. Travelling with a Ukrainian army escort, our reporter James Waterhouse has entered the village of Neskuchna in western Donetsk and has seen with his own eyes how it's just been liberated from Russian occupation.
A journey to a new front line. Only the military can take us this far. Anatoly is leading the way. He's fought against Russian aggression in these parts for 9 years. A battle-hardened soldier who knows this patch. He speeds along scarred roads.
See it landing?
It's soon clear Russian forces are far from gone. Rockets, he says, and they're going to hit us soon.
So now Anatoly is putting his foot down. We are speeding through because over the hill are Russian forces where they've just retreated to. We've heard outgoing mortar fire. And what goes out typically comes back. We've just seen incoming fire a few hundred metres away.
The Russians are on higher positions in three directions. This is the village of Neskuchna, and it's exposed. Its name means not boring in Ukrainian, an obvious irony for a place part of the Russian front line until 3 days ago. One of seven settlements recaptured with the start of Ukraine's counter-offensive. We chased them out, says Artem. This village was under occupation for 1.5 years. These are Ukrainian lands.
This is what we are talking about with these liberations. Villages where there isn't anyone left, where buildings have either been destroyed or riddled with bullet holes, suggesting close-quarter fighting. And it's obvious the Russians are trying to take back what was lost. There's heavy artillery overhead, and this is territory still being closely contested.
Ukraine is hoping to replicate scenes like this elsewhere. But they're going to have to do it on a much greater scale to achieve their goal, their dream of complete liberation. If Neskuchna is anything to go by, it may well be complicated and costly.
The BBC's James Waterhouse on the front line in southeastern Ukraine. A BBC investigation has uncovered numerous cases of torture and extortion of Afghan refugees kidnapped at the border between Iran and Turkey. In most cases, the gangs and smugglers send videos of their victims to horrified family members demanding ransom money, as the BBC's Surin Kobani reports. And a warning that his report contains sounds of torture and may be upsetting for some listeners.
Chained together on a mountain top with padlocks around their necks, a group of Afghan migrants beg for their freedom. One of the men, his lip bloodied and face caked in dust, speaks directly to the camera.
Whoever watches this video, I was kidnapped yesterday. They are demanding $4,000 for each one of us. They beat us day and night, non-stop.
Horrified families are receiving videos like this, showing beating and torture from gangs who are kidnapping migrants trying to reach Europe.
They kidnapped my son. I don't know what to do. We have no money.
For decades, people have paid smugglers to help them get from Afghanistan through Iran and across the border into Turkey. 12 years ago, I made part of the same journey myself when fleeing Iran for the UK, where I was granted asylum. But with hundreds of thousands leaving Afghanistan since the Taliban seized power in August 2021, the route has become busier than ever. And the gangs are taking advantage of this.
When my brother refused to be separated from his family, he was beaten with irons on his hands and feet and on his neck.
Ahmed's brother and family were held hostage by a gang on the Iranian side of the border with Turkey after they tried to flee the Taliban last year. Ahmed had to sell his family's belongings to pay for their release, and they were forced to return to Afghanistan. But their experience wasn't enough to stop him trying the same journey himself 6 months later.
I said, we don't have money. The kidnapper was beating my brother. We could hear it down the line.
We met him when we gained exclusive access to a safe house in Turkey, repurposed from a stable not far from the Iranian border as he prepared for the next leg of his journey. But even those like Ahmed who successfully crossed the border are not necessarily safe. Multiple people told us that the Turkish authorities had pushed them back across the border at night, making them easy targets for gangs waiting on the Iranian side. Mahmoud Kachan, a local human rights lawyer who represents asylum seekers, says this practice, which is illegal under international law, is helping the gangs to exploit people.
It's very much related to the pushbacks, those violations, because it creates a fragile group open to all forms of abuses.
We put this allegation to the Turkish government, but did not receive a response. In the face of similar accusations from human rights groups, the authorities have denied pushbacks, saying any activities to prevent illegal entry into Turkey are carried out within the scope of border management. In Istanbul, Amina, an Afghan woman in her 20s, told us she and her family were held hostage by a gang after being pushed back across the border.
I was very scared. I was terrified because I was pregnant and there was no doctor. We had heard many bad stories that they even raped boys.
After the gang sent a video showing the torture of an unknown Afghan man to her father, he paid the ransom and they were released. But the eight-day ordeal on the border was too much for Amina. She lost her baby. The people making this journey know the risks involved, but many thousands continue to make it anyway, hoping for safety at the end of the road.
That report by Soran Kobani. New research suggests that the world's most famous early human ancestor, nicknamed Lucy, whose 3.2 million-year-old remains were discovered in Ethiopia decades ago, could both walk fully upright as well as live in trees. It means her posture is not replicated in any living species today. With more details, here's Charles Haviland.
Lucy, belonging to the extinct species Australopithecus afarensis, was discovered in northern Ethiopia in 1974, with about 40% of her skeletal bones extant. Scientists have now made a digital 3D model of the lower limb muscles of our small-brained, ape-like forebear. They conclude that Lucy could straighten her knee joints, enabling her to stand and walk upright as we do, and thereby inhabit grasslands, but also that her big, powerful leg muscles helped her live in trees like modern apes. She was therefore a master of both habitats. The researchers hope their study will shed light, among other things, on how we humans lost some of the physical capabilities our ancestors enjoyed.
That was Charles Haviland. Still to come on the Global News podcast, the BBC speaks to Yasmin Lahri, Pakistan's first ever female architect and a true pioneer of architecture for the most needy.
So when they asked me if you're going to put us into these multi-story buildings, I said, well, each one of you will have a courtyard and open to sky terrace. And they said, where will our chickens grow?
Let's turn our attention back to the United States, where inflation, the rate at which prices rise, is at its lowest level for more than 2 years. It's fallen for 11 months in a row to stand at 4%. The decline was slightly more than economists predicted and could encourage the US Federal Reserve not to raise interest rates when they meet later this week. Our North America business reporter Samir Hussain has this assessment from New York.
Given that we're seeing that actually inflation is starting to come down, it is possible that, in fact, the Federal Reserve may decide to do nothing and not to change interest rates, that perhaps this is the time for a pause. There has been 10 interest rate rises since the pandemic and since inflation really began to take off. So all these interest rate rises were done as a way to try and slow down the economy. And for so long, inflation has remained stubbornly high. It is still outside the 2% target range that the Federal Reserve would like inflation to be at, but we are finally seeing that there are signs that, in fact, that their tactics to try and bring inflation down and rein it in, it's actually coming to work. It certainly will appear to be good news for U.S. President Joe Biden as he fights for re-election. In terms of the political game in the United States, it is those who are in power, who are in the White House, that will bear the responsibility for the economy, regardless of what predated that and why it happened that the economy happened to be in this position, which is, of course, the pandemic. So the fact that you're seeing that the rate of inflation is starting to fall and that these tactics are, in fact, working, that does work to his favour, but it's still a very long way away until 2024.
That was Samira Hussein. Authorities in Nigeria's southwest Kwara state say search and rescue efforts are ongoing to find victims of a boat accident on the River Niger. At least 150 people have reportedly died in the incident. 53 people have so far been rescued. Chris Awoka reports from Abuja.
Residents of five communities affected by the boat accident remain in deep shock. The number of casualties is high. The victims were among the over 300 passengers who boarded the boat on their return journey from a neighboring community after a wedding ceremony. Among them was a father and his four children. They are still reported missing. In a statement on Tuesday, the governor of Kwara State, Abdulrahman Abdulrazak, said he is monitoring rescue efforts but hopes to find possible survivors are fading fast. The traditional ruler of Pategi Kingdom, Ibrahim Umar Bologi II, told journalists that river waves overtook the boat and forced it to crash into a tree washed into the river and making the boat capsize. Communities bordering Nigeria's River Niger, which runs through the center of the country, have often been victims of boat mishap. They fall victims of accident as boat operators often overload their rickety vessels in the bid to earn more money.
The voice there of Chris Awoka. Japan's population fell in 2022 for the seventh consecutive year, with the annual birth rate falling to below 800,000 for the first time since records began back in the 1800s. More people are dying than are being born, and the low fertility rate could mean that Japan's population will plummet from 125 million to around 88 million by 2065. In our earlier podcast, we heard about the government saying that it would invest $25 billion to try to reverse this trend. Well, now they've given details about how exactly they'll spend the money. Here's the Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida.
The low birth rate is a problem that concerns society and the entire economy, and it's an urgent issue that can't be put off. So I'd like to tackle this problem with an unwavering resolve. Now is the last chance to reverse the downward trend in childbirth by the early 2030s, when the population of young people will be declining sharply.
So what else has the Prime Minister been saying? Our Asia-Pacific editor, Will Leonardo, tell me more.
They focus around giving more money to young families. So as you mentioned, the annual childcare budget will be boosted by around $25 billion a year over the next few years, and that will be on a par with the front runners in the world at the moment, who are Sweden. And he said the focus would be on direct handouts to young families. Income thresholds receiving these handouts would be removed, and there'll be more money for those with larger families, so three children plus. Childbirth costs will be brought under medical insurance. It's often quite pricey to give birth in hospitals. There'll be more housing help, and also there'll be more encouragement of parental leave and flexible working practices.
Fumio Kishida also wants to tackle and address cultural issues in Japan too.
Yes, he noted that many people thought Japan was a place that was in some ways hostile to parenthood, and he wanted to change that. But the big question is, how is he going to change some of these cultural aspects, especially in the workplace? Japan's known for long working hours. People often don't really have the time to be going around looking to find partners, for example, and also when they do have families, they can't afford to have children. People don't have the same stable lifelong jobs that they used to, for example, and wages have been stagnated for many, many years.
Will $25 billion go far enough? Will these measures do what is hoped?
I mean, this is in some ways, as you said, unprecedented. It's a huge economic financial package to help people have children. If you're a young family, you're going to get a lot more money. But in terms of people meeting each other and settling down and kind of finding themselves in couples, it doesn't really do a lot for that at the moment. Big cities are often built for people being alone. You know, it's common in restaurants, bars and cafes to cater for people who go in alone, have dinner alone. And the other big question is, how is he going to fund all of this? So there's been a lot of criticism about him saying that he's going to fund this without raising taxes. He said he'd try and do that. But analysts say that tax rises are inevitable. And obviously that could eat into the income of those people that he's trying to help out.
Some other countries address declining populations by opening the doors and having immigration to their nation. Japan's pretty strict on this. Is there any sense it might change the needle and allow more people in?
Not really. It is slowly opening its visa system, especially in industries where there are dramatic labour shortages. So there have been movements this year, for example, to allow more people to come. But we're talking in the lower numbers, in the kind of tens of thousands. It's not a huge increase in the way that some Western nations have managed to maintain their labour forces.
The BBC's Will Leonardo. The American Pulitzer Prize-winning author Cormac McCarthy has died at his home in New Mexico. He was 89. His best-known works include No Country for Old Men and The Road, which were both made into films. He was little known until his 60s when he received rapturous reviews for All the Pretty Horses. From Los Angeles, Sophie Long reports.
Cormac McCarthy was a giant of American literature and is celebrated as one of the greatest authors of his time. Drawing his inspiration from the American Southwest, he was known for the crisp prose and sparse punctuation he used to explore a bleak world of violence and outsiders. He lived quietly and purposefully away from the literary mainstream. He gave no readings and only one on-camera interview to Oprah Winfrey in 2007.
Passion. Passion, it sounds like a pretty fancy word. Mm-hmm. I like what I do. Mm-hmm. And I suppose some writers have said in print that they hated writing and it was just a chore and a burden. I certainly don't feel that way about it. Sometimes it's difficult. You know, you always have this image of the perfect thing, which you can never achieve, but which you never stop trying to achieve.
But the mainstream came to him. His post-apocalyptic novel, The Road, won a Pulitzer Prize. It was among several of his acclaimed books that were made into films, along with All the Pretty Horses, which attracted a huge audience, and No Country for Old Men, which won 4 Academy Awards in 2008, including Best Picture. He published his last set of linked novels at 89, just months before he died.
Sophie Long on the life and work of Cormac McCarthy. And finally, Yasmin Lahri is a groundbreaking architect in a field dominated by men. She was her country, Pakistan's first female architect. She works imaginatively and sensitively in South Asia, where climate and natural disasters and economic constraints can make design all the more challenging. Her work has been recognised by the Royal Institute of British Architects, which awarded her a gold medal for 2023. Yasmin spent years designing what was once described as gilded monuments to corporate excess, but her main focus now is what she calls barefoot social architecture. The BBC's Tim Frank spoke to her about a life-changing project for the Pakistani government back in the 1970s.
There was a socialist government that wanted to do something for people who were deprived of most amenities. So I got this chance of building. Luckily, I'd been around my old towns. I'd learnt a lot about traditional ways of building. And I loved what I learnt because, unfortunately, before that, I'd never had a chance to have seen my own culture. And it exposed me for the first time.
That was because you studied and trained in the United Kingdom.
I did. My father had served with the British before partition. We were all brought up under that kind of influence and also led a rather privileged life because it was in the tradition of the British to rule separately and others were elsewhere. So when I got back, I got a chance to be able to understand my own self. And I think that helped me a lot in working for people who are marginalised.
And one of the ways you did that, I've been reading, is you talked to the people who actually might be living in the environments that you were constructing.
I also got a chance to talk to women because they were going to live in them. And I understood that the needs of women were the ones that I had to cater for because they're the ones who spent most time in those dwellings. Whenever you're building for marginalized sections, you have very little space at your disposal because costs are high. There would be only 2 rooms, but then I wanted to have open-to-sky terraces, which could be done with little cost but also added more living space. And that I'd learned from my old town, Lahore, which is a fantastic medieval city. That meant that women were able to do many things on the outside. And this is what's amazing about my whole country. You can do your living outside. And that kind of space was very useful. So when they asked me if you're going to put us into these multi-story buildings, I said, well, each one of you will have a courtyard and open to sky terrace. And they said, where will our chickens grow? So I said, your chicken will be there and your vegetables you can grow and your children will play there. And that's what sold it actually to the people. I'm pleased that that could work out that way.
You have made it a point through your building to create social spaces for women that are away from the house.
You know, Tim, in my country, women are marginalized. They really have no voice. They are quite isolated because they are kept aloof from everything. Architecture, it's a tool to give them agency, the way that they can then start operating in a more comfortable manner and they have dignity in what they do. Architecture has to do more than just building or more than just creating an environment, but creating a way for people to have a dignified life.
And it's not just buildings. I mean, you've got this stove that you've developed as well. I mean, again, unusual for an architect.
We have this amazing Bronze Age city called Mohenjo-Daro, and it's in the floodplain. It's on platforms. It's always safe, or most of the time. By and large, it's lasted for 5,000 years. I mean, there's something in it that's made it last so long. So it is really the platforms. So I use platforms. And so I designed an earthen stove, which is on a platform. And the stove itself is very carefully designed so that you don't inhale smoke, you don't get the disease that you get otherwise from the open fire stove. And it's all very clean. So it's clean cooking. We teach them how to make briquettes, which is out of cow dung and sawdust or leaves. So it's absolutely no pollution of any kind. My motto actually is zero carbon, zero waste. And also now I'm saying zero donor. How can we do without any money coming in if people themselves can build the capacity? So the stove has given this amazing kind of dignity to women who now sit on the earthen platform as if it's a throne when they were on the ground, you know, really crouching. Just that little bit of design really improved their lives. I need architects everywhere in this field because they're the ones who will design properly, who will know what to do. And so if there were more architects, I think the poor will have a much better chance of survival. We have quite a large privileged class. And then we have people who are really, there's something like over 50% below the poverty line. So there's a huge gap. Give the skills to people and then they start doing things. I need to be instrumental in seeing how we can get help to the young. And I'm telling them the world is wide open. There's nothing that architects cannot do because they have the tools of design in their hands. So they can really transform people's lives.
Yasmin Larry, winner of the Reba Gold Medal for 2023. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this one or the topics covered in it, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, the producer Emma Joseph. The editor is Cara Martin. I'm Gareth Barlow, and until next time, goodbye.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.